This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After leading the way to cut income taxes, the Bush administration is preparing to wage an expensive war against Saddam Hussein while already fighting the war against terrorism. The historical connection between income taxes and the funding of wars is part of the story told in the new book, The Great Tax Wars, Lincoln to Wilson, The Fierce Battles Over Money and Power That Transformed the Nation. My guest is the author, Stephen R. Wiseman. He has covered politics, economics, and international affairs for the New York Times for more than 30 years as a reporter and now an editorial writer. His book opens at the beginning of the Civil War in 1861 and concludes at the end of World War I in 1920, the period in which the income tax was enacted three times and overturned twice before it finally became a permanent part of American life. The first income tax was enacted during the Civil War. I asked Wiseman why President Lincoln wanted to create it.
Well, you know, when the Civil War began, a lot of people on both sides thought it would last only a few months and that they could just rely on borrowing to get through. It wasn't until after the Battle of Bull Run that both sides realized it was going to go on longer. And Lincoln had some fateful meetings with banks, of all people, who felt that if they were going to lend the money to the Union cause, patriots though they were, they wanted to know what the prospect was for being repaid. Nothing has changed in that respect. And so the Union was forced by 1862 to look for revenues. They had raised tariffs already, which was the main source of revenues those days, and the income tax became, for a lot of reasons, the thing they had to turn to next.
Was there a lot of objection to income tax?
There sure was. For one thing, the Union wealth was concentrated only in three or four states, mostly concentrated in New York. These were the citadels of Republican support, and there were big objections that the wealthiest states and the wealthiest individuals were going to have to pay more than people in other states. So there was a big battle over it, for sure.
What was the argument on either side?
Well, the argument was sharpened by the fact that they were at war. But the argument is the same that we're having now. What's fair? Is it fair to raise taxes at a higher rate for those who make more money, to in effect punish them for behavior that creates wealth? Or is it fair to expect everybody at a time of war to sacrifice equally, and especially at a time when so many people from the working class were being slaughtered in the war? Remember that you could pay $300 to get out of the war if you were on the Union side. That meant that people of wealth could pay their way out of the war. Around the middle of the war, the Treasury Secretary of the Union, Salmon Chase, his daughter got married, and he spent $3,000 for a shawl for her wedding, bought it from one of the best department stores in New York. Well, it was noticed that that was the cost of 10 men's lives. So it seemed that you had to have a tax that affected the people who, in fact, were making money off the war. New York became a great wealthy city because of its role in producing goods and services for the war.
So when the income tax was passed, did it succeed in doing what President Lincoln wanted, help fund the war?
It helped. It did not provide more than a fraction of the revenue. It only affected the top 2 or 3% of taxpayers, at first anyway. By and large, the Union cause was funded by borrowing, and that caused inflation, it caused budget deficits in the future, especially when the debt had to be retired well into the 19th century, and it made people realize the next time war came that more money would have to be raised from taxes and less from borrowing.
And in spite of that realization, the income tax was rescinded at the end of the Civil War.
In the 1870s and late 1860s, they had the same debate that we're having now. There was a surplus, and Congress decided, guess what? It's the people's money. We should give it back to the people. But a lot of people in Congress said that was unfair because the were big costs mounting up at the end of the 19th century. One was pensions for Civil War veterans, and the other was retiring the debt. But the overwhelming tide was to repeal the tax because it was so hated as a punishment on the wealthy that that side prevailed.
So when was the income tax restarted?
It was restarted during what was the worst economic crisis in American history up until that time, and indeed until the Great Depression. It was called the Panic of 1893. It caused tremendous unemployment all around the country, armies of hobos and unemployed boarding trains looking for work, a tremendous amount of instability all around the country, and as happens with all recessions and depressions, a huge budget deficit in the federal budget. And the Congress and President Grover Cleveland had to raise taxes to make up the deficit.
You point out that by the time this second income tax is being debated, the wealthy were kind of different than they were before that. They were no longer simply the owners of large plantations and estates. What was the new breed of the wealthy American?
Well, after the Civil War, of course, or along with the Civil War, came the Industrial Revolution. You know, back in the 1830s, when Tocqueville visited the United States, he noted that there wasn't that much resentment of the wealthy because they weren't the aristocracy of Europe living in chateaus. They were people who were self-made men and women or families who made more money than others, but everybody else looked upon that as a goal and an ideal for everyone, and they didn't want to punish people who could do that. By the end of the 19th century, there was a sense of imbalance, that wealth was a product not simply of hard work and risk and saving and investing, but of collusion, of coziness with government, getting favors from government, the trusts made deals, the railroad trusts with government. And there was a feeling that wealth was not something that was in reach for the average person. We've been having that debate for a long time. How do we think about wealth? What interested me as I researched this book is that it goes back a long way.
Well, Congress passed a second income tax in 1894, but then the Supreme Court ruled it unconstitutional. What was the Supreme Court's argument?
According to the United States Constitution, all direct taxes, which were thought to be property taxes, had to be paid proportionately in every state by that state's population. So if you had an income tax in which everyone paid the same, that meant that the rates would have to be different depending on the wealth in that state or the wealth of the individual. It would be completely unwieldy to have such a system. But that was what the literal interpretation of what the Constitution required. The main argument before the court was the income tax a, quote, direct tax or not? And when the court decided that it was, it threw out the income tax. But, you know, the Supreme Court then was as controversial as it was in the year 2000. Nobody saw the Supreme Court as acting as anything but the agent of the wealthy and as a group of men who were imposing their vision of society and what was fair. So we have seen the court fall into these controversial periods in the past, just as we have recently.
My guest is Stephen Wiseman. He's an editorial writer for the New York Times and the author of the new book, The Great Tax Wars, which is about the history of the income tax. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Stephen Wiseman. He's the author of the new book, The Great Tax Wars, about the history of the income tax. He's also an editorial writer and former reporter for the New York Times. When we left off, you were telling us that the Supreme Court ruled the income tax unconstitutional in the mid-1890s. How did Congress end up getting around the fact that the Supreme Court ruled the income tax unconstitutional?
There were several attempts to reintroduce the income tax in Congress after the Supreme Court ruled, but congressmen were afraid to send something back to the court that would be rejected again. They didn't want to, many of them, confront the court quite that way. Even some who favored the income tax didn't want another episode in which the court would be discredited in people's eyes. Then came the turn of the century and one of the great accidental presidents, of course, of American history, Theodore Roosevelt, who surprised a lot of people with his agenda, who was seen as radical, busting the trusts, starting conservation programs, taking on business, attacking the malefactors of great wealth. Toward the end of his presidency, Theodore Roosevelt proposed an income tax, but he had no way of figuring out how it was going to happen. It took his successor, William Howard Taft, a much more conservative man, to agree to a deal in 1909 with Congress over a tariff bill in which he agreed, let's have an amendment added calling for an income tax. It would have to be ratified by 3/4 of the state legislatures. In fact, almost nobody thought that it would be ratified. For Taft, it was kind of a freebie. He just threw it in because he could get more votes for his tariff bill.
So how was it ratified?
It was ratified slowly at first. You know, only 12 states could have blocked it. And at first, it looked like the 12 states were there, including New York especially, that could block it. But what happened then was a split in the Republican Party between Taft and Roosevelt. Roosevelt was beginning to think about running again for president in 1912. But by 1910, he split his party open so badly that the Republicans were thrown out of office all across the country in the 1910 elections, including in many state legislatures where they had dominated for many years. The most important was New York, where for the first time in many, many years, the Democrats took over both houses of the state legislature. And the constitutional amendment, which had earlier been rejected by the New York legislature, was ratified. That encouraged other states to go along, and it was put over the top in 1913, literally weeks before the inauguration of Woodrow Wilson.
So Congress passed a resolution to amend the Constitution to permit an income tax in 1909, and that was ratified by the states in 1913. This basically happens just in time for World War I. How was the income tax used during World War I?
Well, it became an essential part of the war effort and raising money to fight the war. Wilson and his Treasury Secretary, one of the great characters I came across in researching this book, William McAdoo, he was also Wilson's contemporary and son-in-law, realized after studying what happened to Lincoln during the Civil War that they had to prosecute this war with taxes as well as borrowing, and they were determined not to make the same mistakes that had been made before. And since the income tax had just been passed, they had a basis for doing so. It only started at a tax rate of 10 or 11%. By the end of World War I, amazingly, the highest tax rate that was enacted was 77%.
Wow.
It's amazed me to see that.
That was a progressive tax, so it was the wealthiest who got the 77% tax.
The very wealthiest, only the top couple percentage of taxpayers in America.
And I assume the rates changed after the war?
Immediately. In the 1920s, Andrew Mellon, who was Treasury Secretary throughout the 1920s, in fact, people said that he was such a powerful Treasury Secretary that three presidents served under him. He led the way. He was probably the biggest tax cutter in America until Ronald Reagan came along. to returning it to lower rates. But even then, it was the Republicans who knew that the income tax was here to stay, and they never tried to repeal it as they did after the Civil War.
So after World War I, when everybody agreed, basically, the income tax is here to stay, what was being taxed? Were stocks and bonds considered income that you could tax? What about inheritance? Was there an estate tax?
Well, the estate tax has come and gone throughout American history, too. There was also an estate tax during Civil War, and then again in the Spanish-American War. Then it was repealed, and then it was enacted again later, and has stayed as an ingredient. There was also a corporate tax that was enacted as part of the original 1909 agreement. That has remained. And of course, the income tax, by definition, taxes income from stocks and bonds. In fact, it was only when Americans realized that the Andrew Carnegies and the great wealthy of the late 19th century, whose wealth was tied up in investments and who were getting income from investments but not paying any taxes on it, they realized that that was the great inequity that had to be closed.
When the income tax was started, it taxed the wealthy. At what point was the income tax more or less across the board?
That didn't happen until the 1930s with the Depression, the New Deal, and later World War II. And, of course, the Social Security tax of the mid-1930s, which taxed every worker on his or her salary. But the foundation for the income tax, and the reason why I stopped the book in 1920, really did occur during World War I, but it became a universal tax after the New Deal.
So again, we have a war affecting the tax.
Absolutely. The income tax was born of war, but it eventually was the means by which we finance the social democracy that we have today.
Well, we're in a time of tax cuts, and at the same time, we're preparing for war. We're already in a war with terrorists. We're preparing for another war against Iraq. Is it unprecedented to have tax cuts during a time of war?
It's always dangerous to use the word unprecedented, but I sure can't find any precedent for it. And I'd be willing, although I'm not in the business of making predictions, to certainly predict that this debate will intensify and that the tax cuts that are planned for the coming years, that our debate over that will intensify if we go to war in the coming months. It'll have to be. First of all, the money will have to come from somewhere. Remember that the Gulf War of a decade ago was paid mostly by our allies. It doesn't look like this war is going to be paid mostly by others. So it's going to cost American taxpayers. And as I say, if the past is any guide, war sharpens that debate over what's fair and whether the rich should be getting tax cuts or whether they should be paying more for government. And there's another, if I could go on, debate that takes place in wartime, which is a generational one. If you look at the Civil War, the Spanish-American War, World War I, and I think World War II, although that's outside my book, there's always an argument, should we borrow and saddle the cost of this war to the next generation, to our children, or should we pay for it ourselves? And you could make that argument both ways. Well, gee, going to war now, that's going to be good for our children, so let them pay for it when they come of age. On the other hand, you could argue, why saddle them with the debts of the wars that we undertake now?
One of the things that President Bush ran on and that he delivered on was tax cuts. Now the surplus that we had is a deficit, plus we're facing war with Iraq and we're already at war with terrorists. And now there's a push to convince the president to rescind some of the tax cuts that he enacted. Looking back historically, do you see any examples where that happened, where recent tax cuts were quickly rescinded because of an emergency situation? And because the whole color of the budget had totally changed.
Not too much precedent for that, but remember that taxes were raised in recent history twice, once by the first President Bush, and of course then by President Clinton. The crisis in that case was an economic one. There was a feeling that the budget deficits were creating a drag on the economy. And then, of course, also tax increases in those years were the price that Republicans had to pay to get Democrats to go along with spending cuts in their area. I think we're in a period now that doesn't have too much precedent, except in one important respect. As I said, we're about to go into war. War is going to be costly. It's going to intensify our debate about the fairness of our tax system. And when that debate takes place, I don't see how we're going to avoid really arguing seriously in the next year or so about whether or not the tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans, maybe the wealthiest 5% of Americans, I'm sure that's going to be reconsidered by Congress in the coming year or so.
Stephen Wiseman, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Stephen R. Wiseman is the author of the new book, The Great Tax Wars. He's on the editorial staff of the New York Times. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.